I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello and welcome to A Pile of Cthulhu. Today we are joined by some very special people. The heads of Studio Hermitage, the creators of many, many, many games. The one we're specifically talking about today is Our Brilliant Ruin. Thank you very much for joining us. Can you introduce yourselves?
I guess I'll kick it off. my name is Paxton Galvanic. I'm the CEO of Studio Hermitage. We've been around for about 2.5 years now. We were initially part of the Embracer Group, which owns Asmodee and Dark Horse Comics, a lot of things. We were part of that organization for years, and over the past couple months, we became independent. But we are a transmedia company, and we're doing a lot of cool things that we'll probably talk about during this podcast. But thank you for having us. And if you want to dive into my background, we can talk about that later. But that's a little bit about me and our company. I'll pass it over to Justin.
Yeah, I'm Justin Achille. I am Chief Creative Officer here at Studio Hermitage. My background is largely in tabletop games. I was a line developer, creative director, etc. on World of Darkness from... I started there at White Wolf in like 1995, and I left. I was a part of it in its various formats through CCP ownership, through its New World of Darkness relaunch, all that stuff, even through the Paradox Interactive ownership. I left in 2023 to come join Paxton and be a part of this. But in the intervening years, I had worked at other game studios as well, places like Ubisoft, where I worked on Assassin's Creed, and Funcom, where I got to work on the Dune game, which is where I met Paxton. At Red Storm, where we worked on some VR games with the studio art director, Andy, who's not here with us today, but then left to do this, work with these great people, including Rachel.
Hi, I'm Rachel J. Wilkinson, and I am the associate creative director at the studio. And my background is similar in that I started in tabletop games, did a lot of World of Darkness, a lot of Vampire the Masquerade writing, and was also doing a lot of stuff with Modiphius and Dune and Dreams and Machines over there, yes. And ended up being the line editor developer for Dune. Yes, sorry. and then landed it at Our Brilliant Ruin, where Studio Hermitage and Our Brilliant Ruin.
Wow. So we'll start off with our very first actual icebreaker question, which we ask every guest, no matter who they are. And that is, if a pint of Cthulhu was any kind of drink, what drink would it be to you?
Well, if it comes in pints, I have to assume that it's something I like. And one of my favorite pint drinks is porter. I love porter. So you are a dark beer, but not a full stout.
I guess for me it would be a pint of Cosmic Terror.
I think for me it'd be a pint of Guinness with some whiskey dropped in and drank it very quickly.
Sounds nice. That's one of the few nice batches we've had.
We've had everything from salmon vodka to, like, I think it was dirt.
Salmon vodka?
Dirt and fish eggs.
That's a thing. That is actually a thing.
That is a thing you can buy.
Yeah.
And do you know what Matt was going to make me drink instead? Because we couldn't find it? Tinned salmon chunks in Smirnoff.
Like the packing water? No,
pretty much.
Yeah,
we met up and we all drank most of what was on the previous list, and some of them were.
One had salt water and
I mean, the Guinness and Monster one was quite nice. Not surprising.
It was all right. So, we already said what your roles are in the company, basically, so we'll skip that one. Why the name Studio Hermitage?
I guess, Justin, you could dive into that, because that kind of, I guess, spawned from... It was you, me, and Andy that created it, but I think it was your initial idea. So you can kind of go into that a little bit.
Some of the thinking behind it was just kind of creative genesis from other studios. We wanted to be recognized specifically as a studio, and of course, Studio Ghibli is one that comes to mind. So something that has a very well-regarded kind of pedigree there. It just kind of sounds good, trippingly off the tongue, Studio Ghibli. And so we took that model, but also the idea of we don't have an office space. We are a completely sort of decentralized, fully remote studio. So everyone kind of gets to build their own creative space, whether that's at their house or whether that's at a working place or however they want to do it. So everyone gets to have their own hermitage. Everyone gets to have their own creative space where they do their work. And so we are kind of a, I guess, confederation of hermitages, all under the banner of one studio.
Fair enough.
That answers that one. So you've told us a little bit about what you've worked on in the past. What is kind of some of the most enjoyable projects that you've all personally worked on, either recently, previously, or whenever?
Selfishly, I think that what we're doing at Studio Hermitage with Arborian Ruin is some of the most impressive stuff, just due to the fact that it's a big transmedia project. I mean, over the years, I've got to work on a lot of video game projects. I got to work on Conan. I got to work on Dune. I've got to work on some pretty big IPs. I've worked on games like XCOM. I've been part of, Call of Duty, Killing Floor, things like that, big IPs. But here, what we're doing at Studio Hermitage, the fact that this is a transmedia brand, that we were doing comic books, TTRPG book, supplements, audio drama, video game, like, it's a world that we're creating, and we get to do it, with us, and the freedom to do it ourselves is super exciting for me. Again, I loved working on some of the bigger IPs, like working on Dune with Justin and with the team at Funcom was great, and all the Conan stuff, that stuff's super exciting. But the fact that we do our own thing and we got to create it from nothing and watch it grow has been very exciting for us as a company for the past 2.5 years. So that's me. Justin, do you take it?
I've wanted to make this particular game for over a decade, so I love what we're doing now, which I think, of course, is obvious. Everyone is a champion of what they're currently working on. Some of the stuff that I enjoyed having done in the past, of course, World of Darkness in its various incarnations, everything from, I started, I think the first book I had written for World of Darkness was the Giovanni Clan book, all the way on up through, we led the development of the 20th anniversary edition there, which people love. I eventually started working in the 5th edition as well, once we were in once Paradox Interactive, I had gone to work for them. So there's a lot of really cool stuff along the way. I got to work in VR as well, so over at Redstorm, we created a game called Werewolves Within, which is One Night Werewolf or Mafia, but it's played in VR around, a campfire where you're trying to find out who the werewolf is, so you get all these great visual effects going on there as well, and that spun off into a movie too. So, I love the big stuff, I love the small stuff, I like that we're doing, kind of a small, important to us thing right now, which really feels thrilling too, because the studio is small. You get to have a great relationship with everyone there. I've worked at big companies where you just literally don't know everyone you're working with, but right now, where there's fewer than a dozen of us working on the project that we're currently doing, and so it's great to be able to kind of zero in and focus on that sort of stuff. So the day to day is a thrill there. Rachel.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to copy both of these guys' answers because it's pretty much the same. I mean, I like what we're doing now. I like the transmedia approach that we had to working on this property. I personally have a various skill set. I can write. I can do sound design. I've done video in the past. I actually worked in videography for a long time. And so there is an opportunity with the small studio to get your fingers in a lot of different pots. And so that's been particularly enjoyable. And in the past, really, it's sort of any project I'm working on is the one that I'm currently enjoying. You find a way to love whatever you're doing. So, yeah, I would say that there's been great things in the past, and our Brilliant Ruin is what's happening now.
Fair enough. So how about you tell us a little bit about our Brilliant Ruin?
Well, Justin, you take it. Yeah, the game, I mean.
Well, I mean, I guess let's start from the perspective of the world. The foundation of the world, I had long been a fan of the television show Downton Abbey, and I thought it would be this prime setting to do a role-playing game, and even one that kind of lends itself a little bit to LARP, just because the visual presentation is so strong. So we started with that kind of snapshot of Edwardian aesthetics, and of course you can't just do that. So we took the kind of upstairs, downstairs social drama, the kind of built-in conflicts there, and we layered in a gothic horror element to it. So we have this, it's not quite Lovecraftian, you know, it's more focused on the individual, on the people, but light from a dead star somewhere else on a different planet or a different solar system has made its way to this world of the game, to the Dramark, and it's eaten away at the edges of the world. It literally is eating away at the planet. It consumes metal. Ultimately, it will consume people and turn them into monsters, turn them into horrible things. So you kind of get that combination of Edwardian aesthetics and gothic horror thrill there that gives you a social dynamic all happening against the background of that, you know, that horror, that sense of personal doom that's encroaching. Oh my gosh, the landscapers are here. Of course, it's Tuesday, right? So there's this noise in the background, if you can hear it.
I will tell you, we don't hear it.
Okay.
It sounds fine.
That's good.
But in terms of the game, and Rachel can speak more to this because we worked on this together as we were developing it, we wanted to focus on systems that sort of pushed the player's emotions into the foreground. We were less interested in who was like stronger or more dexterous or had a higher wisdom stat. Instead, we cared that characters are acting out of love or out of jealousy or out of cleverness. So we built a system that focused on the character's motives and emotional state as opposed to their kind of raw physical potential there. So yeah, super, super high level there about, you know, what is the game. You know, that's kind of the boxes that I wanted to tick as we were working on it. And we got to do great stuff like build in the factions, right? We've got the different aristocratic families that have conflicts with one another and the guilds that have conflicts with one another. And of course, the kind of factions of factions, the aristocrats versus the true folk versus the unbonded who want to change the world, maybe for the better, who knows? I love those interpersonal dynamics. So kind of moving down from the cosmic into the individual, it was a thrill for me there. Rachel?
Yeah, I guess I'll pick it up there. It's really, while you have this gothic horror setting, you also have this socio-political drama going on with the factions, and so that has, that takes up a lot of space in the world. And just to kind of talk about what we were saying about we aren't really concerned about your physical attributes, and that was because everybody is human. There's no magic in the world, there's no religion in the world, there's no government in the world, there's no law in the world. There is just you and your existence, which is very different than cosmic horror, which is very different, you know, getting away from Cthulhu in the sense that it is you as a person. Do define your entire world and do define the things that you do and create your own agendas. And so that human aspect of the game becomes the centerpiece. But if you're not worried about magic and magical powers and all this kind of stuff, when we were talking about it, we just felt like strength, dex, stamina, all of those kind of attributes didn't really apply, because even if you take the weakest human and the strongest human, there, you know, it doesn't really change the world in these sort of superpowery kind of ways. So it was mostly just focusing on why people were doing the things that they did. And as you look at this, as we are living in the last moments of the end of the Dramark and the end of this world, it almost doesn't matter what you're doing, and it matters more why you're doing it. Like, why is this the last thing you're going to do in your life? Why is this the thing that you've chosen to focus on? Because there is no saving the world. This is not a saving the world game. And I suppose in that way, it is a little like cosmic horror. there is no getting out of it. And so you can perhaps make your neighborhood safer for a time, or you can perhaps do things that benefit your community, but there is not this, we are going to defeat the ruin and we are going to reclaim the planet and we are going to save the day. None of that is happening. So it is just really a story about a personal legacy or a personal story and how you're going to face the existential dread of your own demise and sort of trying to highlight what's really important about the actions you're taking or the schemes you're involved in or the role you're playing in this society.
I'll zoom out from the 1,000-mile perspective of Our Brilliant Ruin being a transmedia property is we wanted to create different stories or allow people to tell different stories through different mediums. So that's why we started with the TTRPG book. We wanted that to be our art and world Bible. We wanted people to kind of tell their own stories there. But then we also wanted to give people some stories as well. So we did a series called The Horror at Crane Mansion with Dark Horse. It's a comic book series. We did an audio drama that Rachel wrote and directed called Clawmore Heights, a 10-episode series. That's another story within our world. We have a video game that we're working on very closely right now. Right now that we will be releasing, you know, in a few months to years ish something like that. So we wanted to have people tell their own stories, but we wanted to give them some stories. So big transmedia property, lots of cool things. Tell your own story, listen to some stories, gobble up this media wherever you possibly can. So
well, it was also about being able to engage with the property in whatever level you can engage with it in. So if you are somebody that has a weekly game group or a monthly game group and you want to play a tabletop, that's great. However, if you're somebody who is a busy parent or working a lot and wants to enjoy the property without necessarily having the opportunity to be in a gaming group, you can listen to the audio drama in the car as you commute to work. If you are just somebody that wants to dig into art, there's this comic book series. So it was the idea of finding all of these ways that people could connect to the setting, because I think we're most excited about this Edwardian gilded horror idea, and it is just how to bring people into enjoying that with us.
Hmm. Now, you say Downton Abbey was one of your inspirations, but what about anything else? What further inspired you? I mean, I know you just said Edwardian as well, but surely there must be more to that as well. I mean, what other kind of, what's the most like, kind of weirdest thing that inspired you whilst you were doing this?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff in that particular kind of genre. Downton Abbey, of course. Gilded Age is on HBO Max right now, season 3. I love the Evelyn Waugh books. I love the P.G. Woodhouse, Worcester and Jeeves books. So, you know, the look, like one of our brand values is it's cool to look cool. And when you look into all of these, you know, there's just this very rich sense of costuming and setting and location and just a, you know, very strong visual out the gate. But also other things that are contributing to it, of course, is the kind of Gothic literary tradition, this idea where ultimately the rational wins out over the perceived supernatural, and the individual costs of you know, what decisions people make. You know, we take that, I think, a little more modern, because ultimately, you know, we don't have the supernatural in the game. Everything that we have in the game has a scientific explanation. It just happens so in Our Brilliant Ruin that the rational is actually the monstrous and is what overcomes at the end, as opposed to the traditional Gothic literary where the kind of humanistic wins out. So we sort of turn that on its head. But also, like, with my background in World of Darkness, one of the things that's important for me is the human stories or the individual stories or the costs of the decisions that you're making, the consequences for what you're doing as a character. And so what we didn't want to do was use the same sort of kind of morality tracking stat or humanity style tracking stat. Instead, we push that more into the stories of you did this and now this happens. And that even comes out a bit in the game system, where the game system encourages players to, if you really care about making something happen, use passion, right? Use this game system that makes it more likely for it to occur. But also lean into failure. Failure doesn't mean that you're a bad player. Failure means that a consequence has come up, and now that's a new piece of story that comes into it. And that's one of the things I love about, you know, Gothic fiction as well, is everything is based on the bad decisions of the characters who are focal to the stories.
If we were to simplify it, though, like, I think, Justin, you and I said, if we were trying to explain Our Brilliant Ruin in, like, one sentence, we said, it's Downton Abbey meets Game of Thrones at the end of the world. That was kind of, yep, like, our phrase. Like, yep, if you were to summarize it, you got the Game of Thrones, like, conflicts between different groups, you know, and the social aspect of it, but that setting of Downton Abbey, but it's all set at the end of the world. So Very simple.
Fair enough. Sounds like a good way to facilitate some character-based storytelling. So, you mentioned before that you were associated with Dark House Comics. Was that part of what inspired you to make a graphic novel for the game?
Yes. So, being part of the Embracer Group, we were under the same umbrella as Dark Horse Comics, and there was an initiative for companies to work together to kind of be part of, if you're part of this umbrella, we utilize each other, you know, keep the money within the circle, that kind of thing. So we had a very an avenue to get into Dark Horse and talk with them, and since we were part of that same family, so in talking to them, we knew we wanted to do more Our Brilliant Ruin mediums, projects, storytelling. The Dark Horse relationship, it's probably one of our better relationships. Like, I actually talked to a couple people at Dark Horse yesterday. Like, we have a very good relationship with them. They're actually going to be doing some fun things with our TTRPG book, doing some distribution for us. So that's going to be exciting. And just the creative relationship we had with them making the comic book series, and then that's going to be turned into the omnibus hardcover 90 plus page, you know, it's going to be at Walmart and Target. That book is going to be available in the next couple months, so that's exciting, doing that first project with them. But they have so many cool things going on. I mean, if you look at all their projects between Umbrella Academy and Hellboy, and like, they have so many fun things. It's just nice to tap into that that creative group. They're amazing people. So I still foster that relationship with Dark Horse, even though we're not part of Embracer anymore. We still have a very good relationship with Dark Horse. Like I said, I talk to them, you know, weekly. We talk about projects, things going on. We'll talk about this later, but we have a new Kickstarter that's happening for a quick start guide, and they asked me, like, oh, we're starting to think about doing more crowdfunding things here at Dark Horse. I want to pick your brain about it. So we go back and forth with them. So a very good relationship with Dark Horse, and we continue that to this day. So.
And they've got good TTRPG DNA as well. They, you know, do the print and distribution for the Lancer tabletop role-playing game. They've done some of the comic books for Critical Role as well. So they are enthusiastic participants in the gaming sector hobby.
Yeah, I think they did a lot of the Last of Us art books and figurines and Mass Effect stuff. Like, they've been doing this kind of stuff and kind of supporting video games and games in general for a while now. They're even into film and video, like the film industry. They have a whole section of Dark Horse that, I mean, I think they did the Umbrella Academy, and they have some other stuff going on, so they have a team that's into that. So I'd love to tap into their resources when it comes to the film industry, and maybe hopefully in the future someday do an Arbor and Ruin TV series or movie or something. That'd be a lot of fun. So yeah,
that would be absolutely epic. I'd love to watch that.
me too.
So talking about well, visual things especially, how did you come to the art style that you guys have chosen for Our Brilliant Ruin? What was the decision behind that?
Yeah, the I mentioned before the art director, Andy, I had worked with back at Red Storm, and I loved working with him. And when this project came up to start our own studio, I'm like, I know exactly who I want to be for art director. I talked to him about it, and he delved into it, of course. And a lot of the real world kind of period historical art influences there, we definitely dip into and borrow from. So you can definitely see some Art Deco influence in there. You can see the more naturalistic sort of Art Nouveau elements in there as well. But in terms of a specific artist reference too, there's an artist named J.C. Leyendecker who did a lot of advertisements in the period. So you can even look at things like the Arrow collar shirts. He's done some advertisements there, and, you know, covers for magazines, covers for things like the Saturday Evening Post, stuff like that. And he's got, you know, a very, very signature style. It's very realistic, but then if you look at it and take it apart piece by piece, you can see there's a very strong sense of, like, streakiness and line. It's almost painterly, but it's just very strong. And so that is probably the single most influential individual that we leaned into it, both because it gave us these very bold characters and because it was very evocative of the time period that we're borrowing heavily from.
And we should also talk about fashion too, because fashion was part of, you know, it's an enormous part of the brand itself. And so taking that Belle Epoque, Edwardian fashion aesthetic and winding it back a little bit for the Unbonded so that they are almost a little bit more rococo in their styling, And then you can also speed up a little bit with the Dara family and having more Art Deco lines. So you also have these fashion aesthetics that are influencing a lot of the art style in it too.
And they're cultural as well. Like a lot of times, I'm glad you brought up the Unbonded, Rachel. You know, a lot of the Unbonded wear hats, and a lot of these hats are from what we would associate with even older time periods. And so we get the sense that the Unbonded are sort of picking through the eras of history and taking the not only the ideas but also the personal expression elements and using those as self-identifiers there as well. So you get, you know, kind of the up-to-the-minute Dara, like you were saying, Rachel, and then the ones who kind of choose from sort of history's smorgasbord, like the Unbonded do. We've got stuff that even looks like, you know, 18th century highwaymen in there for some of our signature characters.
Fashion buffet. That's what it is. It's a fashion buffet.
I'll join in and also say that our associate art director, Ephraim Palacios, he's very talented also. He's done a lot of our key art. Andy, as the studio art director, has set the tone for what we're looking for. But Ephraim has created a lot of the key art that you see in our TTRPG book. But he has a huge pedigree. He was at Wizards of the Coast. He worked on Magic. He's worked. He was at Blizzard. He even worked on World of Darkness back in the White Wolf days. Like, he has done a lot of fun things. He's worked at Machine Zone on some mobile stuff. So he's worked on Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. I mean, our you know, associate art directory from he's done a lot of cool things. So whenever you see these great key art pieces, a lot of them were him. And the fun thing about Ephraim is he'll always have a story based on whatever he's drawing or creating for us. He'll have backstories for characters in his mind. It's played out a certain way, and that's why they feel so creative and inviting or scary, or because he's really put a lot of thought into the art and the scene and the characters. So we're very lucky to have him doing a lot of art for us in addition to what Andy's done as our studio art director. So I'll just add that.
Yeah. I was just having a quick flick through there, and I was looking through the styles and saying the fashion and such. Each different faction, they are very visually distinctive, yet they all fit that same style of art. It generally flows really nicely, but it's so distinct. And then flicking through further on, you've got these beautiful painted like landscapes. I think again further on from that, you've got blueprints for houses, and it all really just blends in really well, because it's done incredibly well.
Well, thank you. We had some very, very talented people working with us. So.
Yeah. And it's not just a game. It's not just a comic. There's also going to be a video game. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, how much can we say, Paxton? Let's, we're definitely working on it.
I think we could probably talk about what we're doing, because I would say that in less than a month, we're going to be talking to multiple publishers. So we're currently an independently owned studio. We're not part of the Embracer Group anymore. So we need to find where our funding comes from in the future. You know, selling books and things is only going to get us so far. We have a larger team, so we're going to need funding. So our intention is to take the fall and look for a publisher or an investor for this video game. So we have been making a video game behind this. Justin, I think we could talk about it generally. I could talk about what we did while we were part of the Embracer Group and how that's kind of transitioned. So we were making a colony sim base builder game for a little over a year, very much like Frostpunk, you know, that kind of game. We decided to that was a very large game, a larger scope. We decided to take that down a bit with a smaller team, something a little bit smaller of a scope. So, I mean, Justin, if you want, you could talk about it a little bit, just very top level, what the new game is, because it will start showing up in publishers' hands in the next month. We would like to have a demo up on Steam in a few months-ish, kind of is our game plan. And then hopefully finish it within a year is our game plan with the game. But Justin, you could talk about it from a top level standpoint.
Yeah, starting with, I guess, probably some of the less sexy side of things, we're working toward a kind of self-imposed milestone, right? We are a small studio that is focused on, we talk about the transmedia approach, but ultimately it all comes back to the video game. The video game is going to be the core hub of how we anticipate the most people experiencing this. And so we're working on what in video games is called a vertical slice. So we have a couple of levels that we're putting together that we're showing to various publishers. Kickstarters, like Paxton says, to get some funding put into place. What you will do in that game is if you have, you know, you've got the core book, we were just talking about that, there's a region called Gloaming, and Gloaming is sort of held in the terrible thrall of this vampire, and so the video game is going to tell the story of your group of people fighting back against the ruin, fighting back against this vampire, in, you know, throughout the various locations in Gloaming. So I'm going to kind of hold back on the game type, but overall, it is something that you are ultimately facing against. The primary antagonist is this vampire, but you need to deal with these various manifestations of ruin along the way. Oh, and of course, you have to navigate the kind of social environment of the aristocrats, and the conflicts between the three different factions as well. It'll definitely be more probably action-oriented than the colony sim was, you know, more direct character control there. But overall, you know, this is something where you are going to take the fight to the ruin and see what you can do with that.
Nice. No high society social horror game would be complete without a vampire.
Exactly.
Okay, so getting off of less secretive subjects, can you tell us more about the core mechanics of Our Brilliant Ruin itself and the new quick start that's coming out? Start set, should I say, sorry.
Yeah, the starter set is intended to get you up and running quickly. You know, again, we've talked about the core book there. The core book is about 300 pages. If you're going to read it all, you're not going to get a quick start, right? It's a very substantial book. But the quick start is intended to get you going within even the same sit-down session. The mechanics of the game are no surprise, since given our work on World of Darkness between Rachel and myself, and Pam Punzalan, who worked on the core book as well. But it's a dice pool system. You build a dice pool based on one trait plus another trait, and then you roll the dice pool to see how many successes you get. We call them brills. You're contrasting. You want more brills than glooms. If you have more brills, great, you succeed. If you have more glooms, catastrophe. You know, something bad happens there. So it's a pretty straightforward system that lends itself to picking up quickly. You know, it's not a huge mastery system. It also moves a lot of the narrative over onto the player, since it is a system driven by motivations and emotional states. You're more talking about how you approach a problem, as opposed to, oh, I'm in a fight, so it's always, you know, strength gives me this bonus and then I roll for this. Instead, you know, you can fight with ingenuity plus transgress. You know, let's say you're being clever and want to backstab someone. Completely different dice pool than, you know, someone fighting with audacity plus fight, who's just walking into the fray and punching there. So there's a huge amount of the player can solve the problems how they want to. And so we introduce, you know, a very streamlined, you know, it's a very simple system anyway, but we've made it even smoother, even more streamlined for the starter set. And it has a starter story that was written a little bit by me, but also by Rachel.
Yeah, so the starter set is really supposed to give you like a little bite of everything that you'll find in the world. So you have some social drama with the aristocrats, and I don't want to call it a lawless system. It's not a lawless system, but there you have to understand that in this, there are no governments. There's no one that you can go to and say, fix this problem for me, or this was unfair. Policeman, please arrest this other person. Like, that just doesn't exist. So you have to kind of solve your own problems. And so there are uprisings of people. Communities solve their own problems through community means. And so you have that kind of social conflict. You also have psilokinetics. Psilokinetics we haven't talked a lot about, but they are giant automated machines that were created in history to supposedly make life easier for the people, and go figure, it didn't. It took everyone's jobs, shocking no one. So you have these big machines that are kind of lumbering around and breaking down because the ruin likes to eat metal. That worked out great for us to be able to get rid of a lot of tech, because we wanted this kind of be like a low-tech environment. We didn't want to have a bunch of stat charts and tactical strategy. This is a narrative game. If you are interested in percentage dice rolls, this is not your game. But if you are interested in storytelling based on the element of chance and how things come about through your own actions, then this is perfect for you. And so you can kind of see how that works in it. And then we also have the ruin and the monsters, because no story would be complete without some monster. But I do want to say, it is not just monster fighting, which breaks Paxton's heart. I know. He loves the monster fighting. But you can also social your way out of the monster. So that was one of the very important parts that I wanted to make sure that was in the starter story, that if you really never wanted to touch a weapon, you could still have a really kind of interesting entanglement with the monsters in this world.
But that physical threat is there. There's always that risk.
Of course it's there.
You might get eaten.
That's why we fight it. That's why I love fighting it.
Paxton is the Piedmont Accord member of the group. But he's the one that jumps right into the monster's maw with guns blazing.
Oh, that's me. Yeah. If ever I was to play a character, it's like the paladin character. Like, I'm always, like, up front, like, protecting people and just battling and fighting off things. Like, that's kind of how I play normally. But, yeah, I've had a hand in some of the characters that we've created in Arbor and Ruin. And most of my characters are the gun-wielding, sword-wielding type characters. Not necessarily the handmaiden that figured out the affair that the aristocrats are having. Those weren't my characters. Mine were we're going to kill a big monster with a big gun. That's my stuff.
A little something for everyone. So tell us a little bit more about both the ruin and, I guess, the monsters, as separate as those might be.
Yeah, so starting with the ruin, the idea was that I mentioned earlier that there was this light from a dead star. Somewhere distant, a star has died, and that strange light from its death has made its way to our world. And it's interacted with our world, the world of the Dramarch, the fictional world, of course, very strangely. So this ruined starlight, it corrodes metal, and it acts elementally. You know, given long enough time, it will knock down a mountain. It will turn people into mush, and that's part of how, you know, it affects people very strangely. It changes their makeup, and it makes them very differently interact with the world. And part of what we get from this is that sense of shrinking. You know, we want this idea of tension, where however many people are out there, they're being forced into these smaller and smaller spaces. And so, you know, that creates tension as people are, you know, forced eventually on top of one another. But still, it's a very beautiful world, right? We want it to be very attractive, very appealing, and give you a sense of what the ruin has taken from us, which spurs you to kind of act against it. But then also that idea of light affects sort of every one of these monsters and how they're conceived. So the world has ghosts, for example, and a ghost is a literal photograph of emotional resonance, right? The light has captured this piece of emotion in one moment and made kind of this photostatic idea that then haunts a place. Or the light affects, you know, vampires, for example, and that's why vampires don't cast shadows and don't appear in mirrors, because the light affects their bodies in strange ways. In some cases, it's much more direct. You know, obviously it turns people into flesh eaters or into, you know, chimera, these ravening monsters. The chimera, for example, the light kind of breaks down the stuff of their being, and then other ruined things in their proximity glue together. So these chimera are sort of these mergers, these amalgamations or agglomerations of other creatures. So that gives you things like your werewolf or your multi-headed monster. That's kind of the big picture idea there. I'm going to turn it over to you, Rachel, for your perspective on it.
I mean, you covered pretty much the main points. I would suppose that you'd have to look at the ruin. We call it a preternatural force, not a supernatural force. And that's sort of an important distinction, because we want it to be scientific. We want it to have that rational explanation. We want it to actually be doing something with the physics of the world and not just some magic. In fact, I'm wearing my science shirt. I didn't even realize I was wearing my shirt right there, which you can't see. It says science. It's like magic, but real, which is exactly kind of what we're going for with the ruin. It's like magic, but it's real. And so it is also something that you can study. It's also something that you can manipulate. It's something that you can try to dissect. And so you have factions and even some families who look at the ruin as, I don't want to call it a resource, because I don't know if you would necessarily use it like a resource, but as a thing that can be investigated or molded or dissected for information. And it is a thing in the world. So that's, I also think, is kind of an interesting aspect of the ruin. And I also just really like this idea of eating the ore of the world. So that's how you get mountain collapses and these kind of things. Like, as it is devouring the metal, then anything that is sort of structural falls apart. And so it is also about innovation in trying to figure out how do you make things in a way that don't rely on the what you were doing before. It kind of forces innovation, forces creativity, forces change in very interesting ways. So instead of money, we have ceramic marks. And so you have these other materials that kind of take the place of what metal did in society. And then you also have metal itself, not a gold, silver, platinum, not like the differentiation of value that we necessarily have, but just the idea of metal is very valuable. And so that also becomes part of the personal expression of your family wealth, your personal style, your whether you are risk averse or a thrill seeker. Like, how much metal do you wear? How much jewelry do you wear? What is actually on your attire? And it's this idea that constantly goes back to the idea of the individual person existing in the world. Because one of the other aspects on the monster side of it is you have to think that most of these monsters were all a person at one point in time. They were somebody's mother, brother, sister, father, friend. And they were changed, I guess, transformed, blighted in, you know, all of these things from the ruin. And so you also have that very personal story of your sister has been ruin afflicted. What do you do? And so it has a little bit of those horror tropes where it's like, I was bitten by the zombie. Do you let me live or do you kill me now? So it has kind of that kind of also body horror aspect to it too, which can be fun. We were talking about horror, but it's like, it's kind of fun.
It is.
We had some of our key characters lose limbs. And it's, I think, Rachel, you even commented, we have a voiceover talent that's working on our video game. And he's like, you're giving me another character that lost a limb. I played a character that already lost a limb due to the ruin. So he's like, are you always going to give me characters that are like losing limbs due to the ruin?
He said it was going to be in his contract. He said, I'm going to be contractual. Like, it's going to be a contractual obligation that every character I portray has to have lost a limb.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I was going to say, just quickly, a question then, after all the ruin has finished, what is the end of the world of our brilliant world? What would be the final sunrise kind of thing on a world that is essentially dying?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's one of the things that, you know, like we talked about earlier, tell your story. We want players to be able to kind of start at the very beginning, like what do you, let's say you are first experiencing the ruin, you're the first group of players who are learning about the ruin, up all the way till like this is the last party before the sun doesn't come up the next day, and so the players have the ability to kind of slide their tolerance. You know, if you want this to just be a background element, you can set things comparatively early in the phase of ruin, or you can run right up to the end of it. For players who are familiar with the World of Darkness, think of this as kind of the Gehenna idea, right? Like, the vampires are always worried about Gehenna, the night that the vampire antediluvians are going to come and eat their way through all the clans again. And it can be something that just kind of lives in the background as a stressor, you know, as something providing tension to the clans. or, you know, we even did a book about here are four different Gehenna scenarios. This is the night that it all happens, and turn it loose. So, you know, every story needs a beginning, a middle, and an end. And because we know that ours ends with the literal end of the world, we know that we want, you know, everything to... What do you do with your remaining time is basically the thrust of the story there. It's less about boom, explosion, and then the end happens, and it's more about what are you going to do as the sands of your hourglass run out there.
I find a very fun speculative experiment, because Justin is correct. We want the focus to be on your time is running out as an individual. How are you going to spend it? But I do sometimes... think about what happens when all of the ruin has, when the world has been taken over and humanity no longer exists, but you still have these monsters roving around, and you still have, like, so you have vampires that still have some of their own intelligence and sentience left. You have flesh eaters that have this as well. So they have these, like, remnants of mind still, while you also have, true monsters that have no concept of their own sentience or anything. They're just, you know, they're ravenous beasts. And so then you start thinking about, well, what happens when they turn on each other? So, and that gets
whose blood do the vampires drink when all the people are gone?
Right. I mean, this, you can see our World of Darkness background shining again, as always.
Nice. I mean, but there's always like, what's human cow?
Yes, I mean, but it's like, what happens when you get monster on monster? Right? But that is a different tabletop game. That is a different game. That is a different property. That is not this one.
Yeah. So, with people changing into monsters and with metal being dangerous, what sort of superstitions crop up? And how much is the bias of, like, the fear of transformations or corruption used as a bludgeon by one group against another group in society here?
Oh, that is a great question. I love to see you thinking that way already. What's interesting is it's not necessarily a very superstitious world, to use that word, but it is one that various locations are extremely careful about how they do things. For example, the unbonded, who often have to live at the edges of society, mechanically they get a bonus to, you know, resist ruin or to mitigate ruin, because they're around it all the time. They've kind of evolved these ways to solve the problems. But yeah, you've got problems where people accuse each other of being, you know, deteriorating due to ruin, and obviously you're doing this because you're losing control of yourself. You're becoming a monster. So, you know, even the very accusation can become weaponized, and then you also have cases where it's not weaponized. You know, it's just because you may be paranoid, but they all might be after you, genuinely, right? Like, you might be the monster who everyone has twigged to. So it's something that needs to be managed in society very, very well, because all too easily it can turn into something that throws a community into disarray, or ends up with the wrong people being hurt or even killed. Rachel, there's a story in one of the upcoming Whispers that has just this very element to it, and even in the starter story, we have that element of chivalry in there.
Which one are you talking about? Oh, the... Yes. So, chivalry is the community response to injustice. So, chivalry is this idea of your mob with pitchforks. It is this idea that a community coming together to say what this, again, this individual, or perhaps a few individuals, have done wrong. And so that becomes the weapon of justice in the world, with a bunch of people showing up at your door. And
democracy on demand.
But it's interesting that there's a faction called the True Folk, and the True Folk are your kind of middle class, status quo workers in that sense. Like, they are the downstairs of the upstairs downstairs drama. They are in the League of Glove and Key. They are like a hospitality servants guild. There is Crown Hall College, which are academics. There's Piedmont Accord, which is our contractors. So there is this middle class that has made contracts and agreements with the aristocracy. So they are sort of maintaining the social status quo, and they have these, in those moments of chivalry, the true folk, I believe, in my opinion, become the most powerful people in that moment. Because as you have this mob going to a gate of an aristocrat, the true folk can decide whether or not to let them in or not. They become gatekeepers and deciders. And so it sort of changes the typical aristocracy rules everything, and they make, you know, they decide where everything's going to be, and they determine the law, and they have all of the power. They do own vast majority of these things, but it's a way to have even the unbonded and the true folk still have their power in situations. So there's not like a single faction that's like, I am the most important person in the room right now. An aristocrat might think so, but they don't realize how frail they are in all of the social systems that are keeping them in that place. So, that's the sort of interesting aspect of the social side of this too.
Speaking of the Game of Thrones inspiration, that's that old question I think Varys asked Tyrion. A king, a priest, a lord all in the same room and a sellsword with them. Who's got the most power?
Right. Right.
So, we took your quiz to find out what faction you would end up being. Now, we both ended up with Unbounded. However, what faction would you be? Like, the three of you individually, what faction would you end up in?
Tell you, I'm so mad about this quiz. I just have...
Did someone get aristocracy?
Yes, I get keeping in Galderpark. And I don't even mean... I even know the answers to the questions. And I can, you know, and I will try to change it and be like, nope, you're just a Galderpark. I'm like, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
I'm personally Piedmont Accord. We've already established that. I am the guy that you hire to go kill the monsters or, you know, go investigate something. They're the investigators, the guns for hire. Like, I'm always a Piedmont Accord. So that's part of the True Folk. Yeah, that's me.
I'm True Folk as well. I'm a member of the Rivet and Bellows Union. I've always been a worker. I will always be a worker. And so that's where all my attitudes lie.
Yes, unfortunately, I'm soft and just like to spend money. So.
The things we find out about ourselves with this quiz.
Hey, fair play.
So, I know it'll probably be largely character dependent, but can you walk us a bit how your character might change during the game, even just mechanically? Do player characters have a risk of getting monsterified if they spend too long around the ruin?
Oh, yes, very much so. Absolutely. So character progression is mostly based on your personal agenda. So the idea is that you have personality, you have skills, and you have portfolio. This is your three categories of attributes. Your personality is why you do things, your motivation. Your skills are the things that you're good at, and your portfolio is this outside sort of resources that you could tap, things that you can do with backgrounds, assets that allow you to do these things.
Things that are external to your character.
Yeah, and so as you are playing in a session or as you're playing the game, you might have a particular thing that you want to accomplish, and in accomplishing that, that is what boosts that particular attribute. So if you wanted to do something very audaciously and it was all about this boldness and you were really about being in people's face or whatever, then at the end of the session you might say, all right, I have spent all of this time working on this plan in which I was very bold and very, you know, outgoing. I would like to move that up a point. So that is the progression. It's not an XP spend system. It is a what goal did you accomplish kind of system, and it is a discussion between the player and the GM about how you can master those skills or raise those attributes. As far as becoming monsters, yes. So if you become ruin afflicted, which is a condition in the system, if you will gradually become a monster. And because this is progressive, like you can make it take as long as you need it to take, you can still participate in the party even in afflicted as you are, And so that can create some added drama and conflict within the group as you're slowly turning into a potential flesh eater, and everybody's like, but yeah, but we still wanted to come along with us because he's really great at, you know, XYZ.
All right, so what were the very best and very worst parts of making the game for each of you, the highlights and the hardest parts?
I think one of the hardest parts that I recall was we always knew that we wanted passions, people's emotional state, to be driving a lot of what they did. We had a couple of iterations early on in the system of your traits were measured in terms of like love, for example. And so, you know, we would, in playtests, we would have players say, oh, well, I guess I'm doing this out of love because it gives me the biggest benefit. And like, that doesn't sound like love, does it? Right? And so, you know, we knew we had a system where we wanted to push emotions to the fore, but it took us, I want to say, probably 6 or 7 iterations of that system to get to a place where it actually felt good. And when the player feels strongly about it, like, oh, I really want this to happen, that's when the player opts in to spend passion there. So they actually are passionate about getting the result they want, so they use that system. And that came comparatively late in the development process, where we found that, oh yeah, it works good this way, it feels good this way.
Well, I was just gonna say, we always knew that gamers are always gonna go for their top role. So part of the system is you are equally likely to succeed as you are to fail, and that there is not an advantage for more dice, but there is a psychology of more dice. And so it was the ability to have the players be able to decide how they were going to do something, knowing that they were always going to go for more dice. It was inevitable every time. So we had to account for that, and that's also how that passion system came in, because if you do invoke passions, you get 2 more dice and you get lower your difficulty. So that's the benefit.
I think for me, I'll chime in. I think for me, the hardest part was the battle of, okay, we want to make a TTRPG as our first product, and it's how big do we make this thing? Justin was always like, okay, it should be smaller. We need to have this thing smaller. And for me, I was like, this is going to be our art and world Bible for the first product that we have out there. When people see this, we want them to understand the setting, get a story out of it, you see some of our characters. So I was always pushing for this thing needs to be a little bit bigger, because this is the first introduction to our IP, to our Brilliant Ruin. Like, so we were walking this fine line of, like, keep it small, add more cool stuff. We have all this great art, all these great stories. How do we walk that fine line? So we didn't want this to be this huge tome of information where people feel overwhelmed by it, but not small enough where you didn't understand what we were building. So we had to walk that fine line. So I was pushing for always a little bit bigger. Justin always went a little smaller. So
but I had forgotten all about that. I was trying to get it down to like 64 pages.
I was like,
okay, well,
no,
that's
way.
Not going to happen.
Well, no.
All right, well, it's
going to
be 128 then.
Yeah. He wanted to get it down to 64 pages. And
like,
then he would say, but then I want this, and then I want this, and then I want this.
And then we have to show all the we have to show 5 factions, 5 families, this, and it was like, okay,
it's
now
not
we're talking
64
about
pages, is it, Matt?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, I've got 293.
96. Yeah. Yep. 296 is, I think, at the end of it, but yes.
So I guess Paxton won that one.
I think I did. It could have been bigger, though. I didn't want it to be too big, but it could have been bigger. We could have expanded even more, and we had all these other ideas, and I mean, that's what we have the Whisper for, all these little stories, these in-world stories, so that's why we have these little supplements. But that was my biggest thing, you know, that fine line of too big, too small. You know, make it an art and world Bible, have cool mechanics in it, you know, put everything we need without making it overwhelming for people.
Fair.
Rachel?
No, go ahead. No, it's fine. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say the hardest thing was community property. That was my nightmare. There is a community property aspect of the TTRPG, and because it was a thing that I wanted, and I couldn't make it go. Justin had to make it go. But it was this idea that I wanted something that the players could invest in as a community, and the estates were such a giant feature of this IP. It's like, why is the table not owning an estate? And, you know, dealing with kind of the running, the maintenance, the benefits of having this estate. And to make a long story short, I created a thing called Crazy Spaghetti, and it was Crazy Spaghetti, and it was it's it was a terrible, terrible situation, and I just was like, Justin, I can't do it. There's this idea, please help me. And so it was definitely the hardest thing, but we eventually got it over the finish line, and it was a success in the end, I think.
It definitely works, that's for sure. So yes, it was a success, I can say, you know, in my opinion. So with OBR, when you were developing it originally, what kind of feedback did you get when you were playtesting it, and how did that fundamentally help you create the final product that we have here today?
We playtested internally with not only our design team working on the TTRPG, but also with different groups that were working on the video game as well. And typically, the video game designers have a lot more of a, I guess, mechanical mindset. They're looking at specifically the systems and how to tune that. And our lead programmer at the time, Marcos, and he and I had a lot of back and forth about how the probabilities of the dice rolls, how frequently should successes happen. And for me, one of the most interesting parts of these stories, again, is failure. And one of the examples I bring up is, like in season one of Downton Abbey, Lady Mary fails to keep her affair with Kemal Pamuk a secret. Lady Edith fails to keep the fact that she ratted out her sister a secret. And so a lot of the story, a lot of the tension, a lot of the drama and conflict comes from the failures, and so I knew that we wanted something that let failures be interesting there. And so, you know, there was a lot of back and forth, especially on the mechanical side, about, well, does it feel good to fail? How can we make failure feel better? And, you know, a lot of turning the ownership of that over to the players. But we also play tested with one of the groups that runs our demos. Just this past weekend was Gen Con, and running our demos there at the show was a group called the Wrecking Crew. And so the Wrecking Crew ran some play tests as well. And one of the things that they really helped us find was the kind of spaces between the descriptions for, okay, what does this monster's power mean? Okay, how many times can this monster do this? How effective can this be? And so, you know, a lot of the, you know, on the ground actual implementation came from that group, who is really good at doing it because, you know, they run a million and one sessions of people who are learning the game for the first time. So they were, you know, really zeroed in on, okay, how does the GM know this, and how does the player learn this? So that was a really exciting part of the playtest and feedback process.
Yeah, that is one of the things I've run into as well with game, like writing games, writing modules. You can have the information, you can give the DM the information. Getting it into players' heads is a struggle sometimes.
Yep.
Well, yep. You're living in it. You know, you're living in it. You're talking about it every day. You're working with it. You have these inherent understandings of that, again, those spaces in between, that a player coming in that has never even heard of your game or Our Brilliant Ruin or anything is like, I don't even know what I'm looking at. Please explain this to me.
So, with the success of Our Brilliant Ruin so far, with the new starter set up to go the same, what are your thoughts on further developing the world? What more are you looking to add, if more?
We're always developing the world. Like, there's always more stories to be told. Like, different creatures that have been created, different family stories. Like, we just want to tell more stories within the world. So I think that, you know, the video game will tell one story. That, you know, our new starter set's going to tell another story and introduce people to a different aspect of it. There's still a lot of things that we could expand. Justin, I'm sure you have a lot more to say about that, but yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that we specifically set up also is a user-generated content license. So players who want to make and publish their own stories can do it using the terms of the license that are available on our website, ourbrilliantruin.com. So, you know, you can make stuff and release it on DriveThruRPG, which is where we have the game available, downloadable for free in PDF format. So a lot of this for us is being able to make a world that we can turn over to players and see what they do with it. And then for us, of course, it always comes into different expressions of transmedia. We want to make the video game we're currently making, and then another video game. I would love to, Rachel, you want to do a second season of Clawmore Heights? You want to do some more audio drama? I would love to be able to do more of these.
Fair. So, I mean, with everything today, I think we should try and wrap this up a little bit. So the last kind of question we're going to ask all three of you is, what kind of advice would you give to anyone who is looking to create their own game or anything creative-wise?
Get started.
Yeah.
That would be my biggest, like...
Do something. I agree with
do
that.
Do something, even if it's small. It's that activating energy just to get the ball rolling. Like, that's... I sort of feel like that's the hardest thing, especially as an individual creator, is just to sit down and do it. So bite-sized chunks and just get started.
Yeah, 100%. A lot of people just sit around and they think, I just need to iterate. This isn't good enough. This isn't good enough. I need to come up with a new idea. But the more you get out there, the more that it'll grow and the ideas will grow. I mean, it is, you know, we had a strategy when we formed the company. We wanted to make something new and fun, and we had to get that first product out there. So to Rachel, your point, we just did it. We said, all right, this is it. This is what we're doing now. Next thing. Like, you'll always go to the next thing and keep growing it and growing it. And yeah, I would say that's definitely something.
I think practically, too, for someone who's making their own thing, it's easy to conceive of the world. You know, in your mind's eye, you have this wonderful thing that you want to share with people. But Jay, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about a second ago, right? Like, how does the player know... How does the gamer know what to do? And so focusing on those verbs, you know, all of the characters, if you read the individual factions in our Brilliant Ruin, there are several verb examples that are unique for each one of the families and guilds, and also overall, you know, what are the verbs that make an aristocrat? You know, they do, or they own, and they have, and they spend. And so, like, what do the characters do? What are the verbs that makes this something you play as opposed to just passively consume? And then how does the player know to do that? You know, if a magic user is defined by using magic, of course you're going to give them spells, right? So what are the systems then that drive the player to do the thing that you expect them to do in the game? How do you get those in front of them?
Well, yeah. Thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. And again, I say thank you for giving us your time. I can only imagine that you guys are incredibly busy over there. And
we are, but we appreciate your time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was really nice meeting you both.
Yeah. And I would say as a final note, like, we have our Kickstarter that's starting up within the next couple weeks that people are going to get the quick start guide. Please follow that, share that with whoever you can. Like, we just want more people following that. Keep an eye out for our video game, but our products are always also available on Amazon. We're going to have more distribution of our products. We're working on localization or translating and additional licensing deals. So we're trying to get across a couple different countries. We're in talks now about that. So we're trying to grow it as best we can, but our product is available, and follow the Kickstarter.
And more people talking about it helps us too. Yeah. So if you know anything that you can do to help, you know, make people aware that it exists, yeah, that'd be great.
We have a couple influencers that are going to be talking about it very shortly. We have a handful of them that we've been trying to get on board, some well-known TTRPG influencers. So you'll see some stuff on social media within the next couple weeks about that. So yeah.
Very nice. Well, again, thank you very much for your time. This has been a Pint of Cthulhu signing off. Bye-bye. All right,
thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, y'all.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile. And you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just... fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations, because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.